Hi. How was your meditation? Good. Yeah. It's intense, isn't it? It can be. I myself was reflecting during the meditation on how beautiful it was 1 minute, and then noticing some back pain the next, and I'm like, wow, this is intense. Life is really intense. The word that I like to use to describe it lately with myself is poignant. I love that word. Poignant. It encompasses it all. It's just poignant. You know? I guess maybe, you know, I'm in a particularly poignant time of life right now myself. I'm about to get married in 1 month and 1 day. It's very exciting. I won't point him out because he'll embarrass him. But it's a very... I've just never experienced a time of life like this before. It's very exciting. In so many ways, I just feel so open-hearted. I cry at everything just because there's an openness of heart. Very easily fall into gratitude for the blessings in my life. Happy time. And yet, in a way, I've noticed myself suffering more than ever before. And not because wedding planning is difficult, though it's tricky. No, with the openness of heart, with the deep love that I've been feeling, I also feel this kind of feeling. Like, I've even heard myself say many times in the past couple of months, don't die. Ever. And really mean it. Really feel that. You know? So I notice often there's a friction in my heart. This kind of heat. This never wanting anything to happen to him. I can't even imagine what it's like to be a parent. Some of you must be sitting there like, you wait till you see what it's like to be a parent. But still I feel that heat of the wanting, of the not wanting certain things to happen. So it's an interesting thing to practice with, both of these, the poignancy of it, you know? And I do this reflection with it, and it might sound a little weird to you what I do, but this is what I do when I notice whether I'm alone or whether I'm with him. I do this reflection that I created where I let myself go with the fantasy, the horrible fantasy of his death. So he's actually a traveling musician, and he goes all around the country for his job. So all the time he's on planes. And so my fear and anxiety is sometimes around this. And I let myself see the whole scenario play out. I sit there, kind of bravery and courage, and I imagine I got the phone call. He's not coming back. And in the visualization, in the imagination, I really allow myself to open up to what that pain feels like. Maybe some of you have experienced that pain. It's really intense. It's really unpleasant. It's horrible. And it feels as if I'm drowning. Like, I'll never get through this. This is way too much to handle. And in the imagination, it really has that quality of drowning in water and reaching for something, anything to make it not true, to undo it, something to make it better, right? And in this, I let this unfold, and it's like this for a long time, and I'm sitting there, and then somehow, always, the thought comes in, you've always been okay. Bad things have happened before. You've always been okay. So just that of like, and then it goes deeper. Like, oh, this is really how it is. You know, just the truth of it. Everything's changing. And then, even deeper, I drop into this mystery. I don't know why anything is happening the way it's happening. And then, even deeper, just into the present moment. It's really scary to think of what life will be like without him, but right now, here I am. And just these reflections on these different levels of truth bring in this coolness, this like cool balm, this salve that sort of eases that friction, that heat. So it may sound like a strange reflection to do right before getting married, but it's been really poignant. It's been really powerful for me to just sit with that. The feeling of attachment, how intense it is, and then dropping in to really what I take refuge in. That's what I really drop into, the refuge of truth. Yeah, it's impermanent. And also the refuge of the present moment. You know, we chanted those refuges together. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the truth that it's all changing. Then we think about that. I take refuge in the fact that I never know what's ever going to happen ever. Because it's truth. So we come to this path because of some deep suffering, many of us, right? Maybe we've lost somebody close to us, or somebody's left us, or maybe something happened one day and it was as if the whole rug was pulled out from underneath us and we don't even know who we are, where we are, or what we're supposed to do anymore. Maybe we just watch the news, you know, these big sufferings. Or maybe we're just really stressed out. You know, we're married and we have these kids and we have to bring them to school and then we have this job and we're also trying to perfect the art of sea kayaking and we want to be good at this and that and, you know, do all these things. And it's stressful, you know, just to make it all happen. And we just have that feeling of stress. That's another translation of the Pali word dukkha, suffering, just stress itself. Maybe it's not something so big and maybe we're not even that stressed out. Maybe everything seems to be just fine. Everything's cool. I like my life. Yet it's like there's this little gnat in our ear. Just this little nagging of like, there's something missing. There's this little void, just something, you know? Like everything's fine, but there's just something more. And it draws us to practice. This is what draws us to practice for most of us. His suffering, stress, or just that quality of unsatisfactoriness. So we're called to this practice. We find ourselves in a Dharma hall. You know, at some point or another, we hear a Dharma talk and somebody says, there's suffering in life. And for most of us, it's like an opera, you know, like music to the ears, like, oh, finally, someone's saying this. Someone's admitting it. Gosh, you know? It's just like the sweetest nectar we ever wanted to hear. Because we know that so many people around us are really trying to fight this truth. We're trying to numb out to suffering. And then a teacher says, it's okay. There's suffering in life. You didn't do anything wrong. I know for me, I spent the whole first part of my young adulthood, and certainly my teenage years, really trying to fight this truth. There's not suffering. I'm going to be happy and I'm going to be high and we're just going to be great, you know. I'm going to completely numb out. And one of my first retreats I ever went on was this young adult retreat at Spirit Rock. It was a week long. And the teacher, Deborah Chamberlain Taylor, put on this beautiful, you may have heard it, this poem by a Tibetan teacher, Nyoshal Ken Rinpoche. And in the poem he says, in this beautiful accent, rest in natural great peace, this exhausted mind, beaten helplessly by karma and neurotic thought, like the endless fury of the pounding waves in the infinite ocean of samsara. Rest. Just find rest. And when I heard that, I was like, I just cried, actually, for hours, out on the trails and the paths behind Spirit Rock, just weeping. Finally, resting in the truth, willing to open to it, to the surrender. This is the first noble truth. I'm going to talk about the Four Noble Truths. Philip Moffat, someone mentioned him. He's a Spirit Rock teacher. He says that all of the Dharma can be revealed to us in these Four Noble Truths. And it also includes the Eightfold Path, so we get a little bit of more space. But if we didn't have any other teaching for the rest of our life, this one, these Four Noble Truths, would take us there to true lasting happiness, enlightenment. So I think it's a worthy topic for reflection. So we got number one, there's suffering in life. Okay, if you can open to that, if you can surrender to that, if you can welcome that in, then you can start the path. Yeah. And then the second one, well, why is there suffering? That's not the right question. Who knows? Yeah. That's some existential question. But the Buddha answers the question, what is the cause of suffering? He has a very systematic approach to these teachings. What is the cause of suffering? And then he tells us that the cause of suffering is craving, wanting, not feeling, or not wanting. Never die. You know? Don't go. Or I want to be this, or I don't want to be that. Includes not wanting to have, not wanting to be, wanting to be someone, wanting to have something. And it comes in these really gross manifestations that are really obvious to us. We don't want something to die, or we just don't want the situation to be what it is. And then it comes in these really subtle manifestations. And the deeper we get into practice, the more we can see the subtle manifestations of craving. And this is the beauty of practice. This is the beauty of also retreat practice. When we get really quiet, we get to see how crazy the mind is, really. It becomes really funny. Wow, how much craving is going on all the time in our experience. And it's fun because when we see it, then we're closer to letting it go. So, suffering is not caused by the fact that we get sick, that we die, that we lose everything. That's not the cause of suffering. The cause of suffering is the reaction in our mind to these conditions changing all the time. It's an important thing to know. I fall into that myself all the time. No, suffering is my reaction in my mind, not what's going on. So I have a fun story that was actually very profound for me. 2 years ago, a year and a half ago actually, I went on a 5-month retreat at the Forest Refuge in Central Mass. And I started having a lot of fun with this exploration of craving, of tanha, but on the really minute level of it. So one day I was sitting on, they have this beautiful porch, I don't know if any of you have been there, some of you have actually, I know. On this beautiful porch, and it was autumn, and I was just sitting there drinking a cup of coffee, and the leaves were changing, and I noticed a big pile of red maple leaves. And I was just feeling just there, very timeless. And then my awareness, my attention landed on the single red maple leaf. And first I just noticed, oh, I'm seeing, just mindful of the experience of seeing. And then I noticed, wow, that is a beautiful leaf. And just took it in. It was like I was drinking it in. And then I started feeling this little friction, this little heat. And it was so subtle. It was just a leaf, right? But all of a sudden, I felt in my body that I wanted to have the leaf. So I saw that and I was like, well, you can get up and pick it up and put it in your hand, you know? And then I really was reflecting on it. I was like, okay, I could do that, and then it would be in my hand. But it was like I was imagining it in my hand and feeling like, no, that's not enough. I want this leaf. It was as if I wanted to consume the leaf. That was the feeling of like, I have to have it more, you know? And it was funny, but it was powerful to see. It's like, it isn't just enough for me to know that I'm seeing. To see, to be with the leaf. It wasn't enough, and it was just a leaf. But I was suffering in that moment. And then later I was doing some eating meditation. Some of you may have done this, you know, lifting, placing, chewing. And I was doing that. I was like, okay, I'm doing this and being very mindful. And then at some point I was like, okay, well, what else am I supposed to do then? You know, I was like, nothing more. This is just it. That's it. That's being mindful. That's just knowing what I'm doing. Nothing more than that. And so it spawned a period of practice that was very alive for me. Just the seeing of this amount of craving on this subtle level brought so much energy. Insights do that. They bring so much energy for our practice. So can it be enough? Right? You've heard that before. It's enough. Whatever it is, it's enough. However hard it is, it's okay. Right now, it's okay. Last spring, I was teaching a class through Mindful Schools for mostly teachers, introductory mindfulness class, and I threw out the question one day, what if it never got any better than this moment right now? And someone in the class, I wish I could really explain the look on her face, but I'll show it to you. It was something like, it was really that big. Like, no way. I don't know if it was a boring class or if she was tired or what, but she was like, not going to have that. No way it's never going to get better than this right now. You know, I share her sentiment. I first heard a teacher say that at Spirit Rock on one of my first two-month retreats, and I had the same experience. It was a difficult sitting. My back hurt. I was hungry. No way. You know, but we know this. This is the only moment that we have. What if it never got better? What if this was it? Let's try it. Close your eyes for a moment. And just notice what your experience is right now. If you're somewhere else, if you're here, no judgment. What if this was as good as it ever got? Is there anything redeeming about this moment? Can we access the mystery of being alive in this moment? Ram Dass has this quote, plumb the depths of this moment. Whatever it is, the mystery is alive in it right now. We just forget. We just forget to look. So the second noble truth, or the third noble truth, this is the good news, right? Yeah, there's suffering and it's caused by clinging and craving, but there's an end. Yay! And just like the cause of suffering comes from the experience in our mind, likewise, the end of suffering comes from the power in our mind, the potential in our mind to see through the roots of suffering. So, you know, this practice of reflecting on my fiancé's death might sound a little weird, but it's actually, the Buddha actually asked of this for us to do this each and every day. One of these five reflections, reflecting on our own death, our own sickness, our own old age, that we're going to lose everything, that we're the heir to our own actions, you know. Even in the Satipatthana Sutta, he offers us all these death practices, because it gives us a taste of what it feels like to sit with peace in the midst of changing phenomena, in the midst of fear of really scary things. How can we sit with it? So what the third noble truth is pointing to is true lasting happiness that's not dependent on any conditions staying in any form. True lasting happiness. This is awakening. So how can we experience freedom from suffering, happiness, lightness, in the midst of everything changing all the time, in the midst of groundlessness? And Joseph Goldstein, many of you have heard of him, is he started IMS, and he has this lovely image in this book that I read about this practice being like you're jumping out of an airplane, and then you go to pull your parachute and you realize it's not there or it's broken. And so you're free falling and you're free falling, and then you just realize that there's no ground. There's never going to be a ground. That asks a lot of us to feel comfortable in that, right? Come on, even in the Bay Area, we want to be grounded, we want to be centered, you know? All these grounding techniques, you know? But it's nothing solid. You know, it sounds cliche, but it's really true. We know that. So, you know, it's interesting with this whole enlightenment, with this Nibbana, you know, and Pali thing, because we don't really know what it is, right? Unless some of you are enlightened, and then, you know, you should be up here. But I'm not. I don't really know what it is. It's like we have these concepts to point at it. But we've all experienced flavors of it. We have, or else we wouldn't be here, because this is hard, right? But something is bringing us back to the cushion, to this practice. Like, you may have been sitting, you may have had the experience of sitting and have really intense back pain. And all of a sudden you're sitting and you're working with mindfulness and you just see it as changing phenomena in the body. Not yours, you didn't do anything wrong, no judgment, just stabbing, heat, nothing to change. You're just watching it. You're grounded, you know, you're centered. You're free in that moment. Because it's painful, but you're not suffering. You're just able to see it, be with it. Or maybe you've had an experience sitting where you can't really feel where your body starts and the air begins, kind of thing like that. You just feel that interconnection so deeply, and it opens the heart, shows us a feeling the body in a way we've never felt it before. These are flavors of awakening. These are equanimity, their interconnection, their compassions, loving kindness. And these are flavors of awakening, and we've all experienced it, you know. And this brings us to the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path gives us this great framework to do this, to experience more and more of these moments of awakening that we've tasted till we're fully awakened, till we've seen clearly all the roots of suffering in our mind and they're uprooted. It's really possible. I believe it's really possible for us if we really walk this path with heart, with care. So it's like stepping stones, you know, these eight stepping stones, but it also works as a spiral. It's also kind of a systems chaos theory sort of path too, each one informing other ones and them popping up at any time. But we'll talk about it in the form of a path, and then I'll talk about it in how it's a spiral, because we start at the beginning and we go through the path factors and then we find ourselves at the beginning again, but with a deeper understanding. So we just spiral in and in with deeper understanding. So, I kind of secretly wanted to give this talk because, you know, it's the Eightfold Path and it's very important, right? It's the way to come to liberation, but I can never remember what they are. Like wise view and something about concentration. So, I have it written here and I'm just going to see if I can not look and say what they are. Okay. They're broken up into three categories. There's the wisdom category, and in the wisdom category, we have wise view and wise intention. Then there's the ethical conduct category, and in that, there is wise speech wise action and wise livelihood. And sometimes you hear it as right, you know. So you might hear me say either one. And then the last category is the mind development category. And in that we have right mindfulness, right effort, and right concentration. Okay. Spent a lot of time on that. So wise view. Wise view asks us the question, am I able to see my life, all my interactions, all the circumstances, in through the lenses of the Four Noble Truths? So basically, am I able to see where I'm causing myself suffering or causing other people suffering and where I'm alleviating it? So holding the Four Noble Truths as the ground of our lives, the ground of our practice, as a ground of our being. So are we using our life basically as our path to waking up? In any moment, everything, every interaction, everything we do, are we using it as a tool to wake up? Asks a lot of us. So what I use for myself around wise view, my little mindfulness bell around it, is if I ever hear myself saying, oh, why is this happening to me? Yeah, that's unwise view. Why is it happening to you? Because you're human, right? And this is what happens. We get sick, you know. Or why is this happening right now? God, why is this happening right now? Couldn't be a worse time. Because there's no plan, you know, because things happen. That's wise view. Understanding that things are impermanent. Understanding dukkha, suffering. Understanding that you don't have to take it personally. Things are just happening. So really understanding the characteristics of existence, the Four Noble Truths. And this feeds beautifully into wise intention. So am I using my life as a practice? And then looking at every thought, every action, every word we say, where is this coming from? Is this coming from harming, a place of wanting to harm? Is this coming from a place of, you know, not maybe I'm not wanting to hurt you, but maybe sometimes that, like I want to hurt you. You made me mad. Or maybe is it coming from a place of just building up an ego, a really solid sense, a sense of self, which also lands us in suffering? Or is this coming from a place of loving kindness, from a place of compassion? So just knowing in any given moment what's going on. It's my favorite thing to practice with lately. Just the Buddha said, everything rests on the tip of our intention. It gives us so much freedom when we know why we're doing something. This is such a key part of our path. Because when it's very clear to us why we're doing something, then we're not in delusion anymore. Even if we still do the unskillful thing, even if we still act out of greed, you know, or wanting, we can be kind around that, but at least we're not in delusion. At least we know why we're doing something. And I feel that that's, you know, nothing will change until we at least know that. Because it's not about just being good. It's really about seeing clearly what's happening in our experience. I had a really strong and powerful teaching around this when I went on the 5-month retreat. You know, because you can do the holiest of deeds, but if they're coming from an intention that's not wholesome, that's the fruit that you'll, you know, eat. And I learned this, that one of my motivations, one of my intentions for going on that long retreat that I didn't see before going on that retreat, and there were many intentions, obviously, for going on that retreat, but one of them that was strong and powerful was that I wanted to be really good. I wanted to be a really good practitioner. I wanted to be the best practitioner who went on a really long retreat. You know, sounds funny, but I went in there, and I really didn't see this at the time. I was really disillusioned with life and trying to be, really striving to be all this, and yet that was also the energy that was motivating going into this retreat. And so there I was, and the first month I was doing a pretty hardcore concentration practice. And I ended up finding myself in these 3 and 4 hour sittings. I had no one telling me to do that, but that's just what I ended up doing. And then in between these 3 and 4 hour sittings, going back and forth, you know, doing the walking meditation and not really ever going outside, getting fresh air, because this retreat center is very enclosed, womb-like. And I pretty much missed the first part of autumn altogether, just doing this practice, until I started getting this shooting pain all up and down my back and my shoulder. And I pulled 2 ribs out of place from sitting like this, you know, but with the energy of striving, of trying to be the best. I was trying to prove to my teacher that I was really good at concentration practice. And I sat with that pain for weeks. Concentration also helps you kind of not have to pay attention to that stuff. But the pain got so intense that I couldn't sit with it anymore. And finally my teacher said, okay, you need to go to the chiropractor now. And that's kind of an intense thing when you're on a long retreat to leave and go. So it was a wake-up call. You have to leave, you know, because you pulled ribs out from sitting. You know, it was funny to say that to the chiropractor. It wasn't funny at the time. It really woke me up to how much I was striving in my practice. And then I saw so clearly how much of my life was being motivated by this energy of striving, of being the best, really having to prove myself in the world. I know I'm not alone here. I know there are other people that have that experience as well. And it's really painful. And so when I saw that, I sat with the decision for a couple of days. Am I going to stay? Because I never want anything to motivate me. I don't want this to motivate me anymore. I'm done. I saw the pain so clear that I was just done. And I saw that that was what was motivating me to be on this retreat. So I don't have anything to prove to anyone. And then, you know, just sitting with it for a couple of days and reflecting on that and reflecting on my deep love for practice and the benefits that I've reaped from my practice, and then talking with the teacher, I was able to see that actually there was a lot of other intentions, really wholesome intentions, and that I wanted to stay. So I stayed. But for the rest of the 5 months, I really worked with that. I saw it just, you know, also in very subtle manifestations all the time. And you may have heard James, you know, who leads this sangha, say, oftentimes we have a couple of intentions in any given action or anything we do. And he says, just focus on the wholesome one. It's okay, we're not perfect. We have all these different intentions, and some are wholesome and some are great. Put your energy in the wholesome, and that will strengthen that one. I love that. I love that teaching. So this brings us to the category of ethical conduct, sila in Pali. People don't really like to talk about this. I don't know why. I think I do know why. This is a hard one, you know. Really, what I ask myself is, am I living in alignment with my truth? Real truth. Not myself deluding myself, but the real truth. You know, in the West, we like to come and practice. We like to sit. We don't want to really talk to anybody most of the time when we meditate. We're going for the freedom. We want the practice. You know? And we don't really want to hear about the precepts that much. You know? That's cool. But we want to practice. And in the East, in the way it's laid out in this Eightfold Path, it comes before the mind development, comes before the practice. You know, we have to have the ground of a solid ethical life, and that will look different for all of us. But we have to have our lives aligned in truth before we're really able to get anywhere in practice. You know, if you're cheating on your wife or your husband and you try to sit down and meditate, it's going to be hard. If you're cheating on your taxes, if you've had 3 glasses of wine too many, it's going to be hard to meditate, right? It's just regret also takes up a lot of space in the mind. Drama. I know this well. My first 2-month retreat, I think leading up to that, I had done some retreats, but I think the only precept, I'll tell you what the precepts are in case you don't know them, not harming, not killing living beings. And that's up for interpretation, right, for each of us, what that means for us, what our truth is with that. Not lying, using wise speech, not harming through our speech, not stealing, not taking what's not offered freely, not using intoxicants, which cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. So this is another one that people don't like to talk about. But it's what's true for us, right? What's your limit of what's blocking your clarity? It looks different for all of us. And using wise sexuality, not harming through our sexuality. So before this 2-month retreat, I had done some practice. Yet the only precept I was following was not killing things. Really. So a little tortured young adult kind of thing. And I decided, wow, I really need to go. And I was really called to this 2-month retreat. I really want to go. And it was really hard. So hard. I sat there day after day squirming with restlessness in my body. My mind was going a mile of the minute, replaying things I've done over my whole life, things I've said, oh my God, and trying to sit there like a Buddha was the hardest thing I had ever tried to do. And yet during those 2 months, I mean, but my love of practice was strong, and even though probably 5 times a day I wanted to literally run out of the hall screaming, I was able to get some really clear insights into my personal story, my personal life. Oh, that's why. Really personal insights. Oh, I see, this could be changed. And they were liberating on a personal level. So in the end, it was a very powerful experience, and it motivated me for the next 3 years in doing a lot of long practice, a lot of longer month retreats. But I had to come out of that and really examine, wow, this is my relationship to these precepts, and it was ugly, you know. I had to change a lot of things, and it was a gradual process, so I'd start to change things to be, and really it has a lot to do with loving our, for me, had a lot to do with loving myself and finding a place where I felt like I belonged, a practice in which I felt like I belonged, and that helped me come in alignment with my truth, with my intentions, for my actions. And so as I got deeper into practice and my moral and ethical behavior gotten more in alignment with what I felt was true, by the time I went on this 5-month retreat, I was able to start having insights into the 3 characteristics of existence, the classical insights, the liberating insights that are across the board the same for all of us. I mean, we experience them in the same way, but insights into, oh, that's, this is impermanence, really seeing it in a liberating way. Oh, this is what anatta meant. Whoa, wow, it's amazing. This is how no self is working in the mind, or not self. Instead of, oh, that's why I did this, or that's how I work with this, less psychological, more universal truths. These are the liberating truths that lead us to enlightenment, awakening. So we can get those, we can get to that place when we have the ground of ethical behavior. And I find it interesting that wise livelihood is in there. And in the classical teachings of the Buddha, it really means not selling drugs, not selling weapons, no prostitution, these kinds of things. Jobs around non-harming. And I love it for us because we're all lay people here. We're not, and monks and nuns have it pretty much figured out for them. You know, they're just monks and nuns. They're not doing anything. That's harming. That's their job. It's easy. And it's not easy, but they don't have all these choices around livelihood, but we do. And then we can ask ourselves, what's motivating my livelihood? Is my occupation coming from a place of building up an ego, of wanting money, of wanting to be really cool, to have the status, or want to be a doctor, from a doctor? Or is it because I really care about healing people? I really deeply care. I have this gift, and I want to share it. This is what I'm supposed to do. know, these are two very different qualities around livelihood. I honestly, I notice that with myself a lot. Like, okay, I get to go teach mindfulness, you know? And I'll notice sometimes that, oh, I get to say I'm a mindfulness teacher. That's pretty cool. It's a cool thing to say. Sure is better than saying I'm a nanny, you know, which I was a couple of years ago. You know. It feels easier to say, I'm a mindfulness teacher, you know, and I see that that is puffing up with ego, right? And that's a little bit different than, I really care about these kids so much and I really want to give them this tool that I know is going to help them in life. When I'm able to hold that job in that light, it's a whole different energy going into these classes. Just, I really see these kids. You know, versus like, okay, I got my story, got my lesson, I'm going to be really good, the teacher's going to like me. It's so different, you know. So whatever it is it coming from a place of loving kindness, of caring, versus ego, money, you know. And again, maybe they're both there, but let's focus. Let's just do that subtle shift to loving kindness, compassion, care. So, we get to be in the, now we're here, mind development, where we like to talk, what we like to talk about in the West, we like to do. It's so great. I love mindfulness. That's the first one. I'm so passionate about mindfulness right now. I'll start with what mindfulness is not, what is wrong mindfulness, because I had this view for a long time. Lots of you have been on retreat, yeah? Spirit Rock, different places. And sometimes you see people crouched over at a little ant or a bee, and they're just like, for hours it seems like, just like, you know? I myself had this view that mindfulness is, because I've had this experience, I'm in the trees and my hair is being blown and the sun is on me and I don't have to talk to anybody and there I am, I'm in the present moment and I thought that was what mindfulness was because I was in the moment, right? And that's actually joy. That's rapture. And it is so important on this path. It really, it's one of the factors of awakening, really. But it's not mindfulness. I like the Jon Kabat-Zinn definition of mindfulness, which is paying attention with intention in the present moment without judgment. So just knowing what's going on in our body, in our hearts, in our minds, without any judgment, any pass-fail kind of thing, any I'm so bad or I'm so good, just seeing what's happening, not needing anything to change. Just observing, just paying attention. So then how does mindfulness, if it's not just about being in bliss and looking at the ants, how does it meet difficult mind states? And this is what I love about mindfulness. It really is helpful, difficult mind states, and really elated ones. How does mindfulness meet a moment of loneliness, for instance? Loneliness arises. And when mindfulness arises, we might notice, wow, I feel really tight in my throat. Notice tears are maybe welling up. Maybe I feel cold. And then mindfulness can start noticing what the thoughts are in relation to the loneliness. Wow, these thoughts are the ones that play around this. They can be aware of all that, just seeing it. Not needing it to change, nothing to do, just seeing all of this. That's it. That's it. But the question I like to ask in relation to mindfulness is, what's actually the best way to be with this right now? Because sometimes it gets sticky, like with difficult emotions like loneliness. Loneliness will come and you're feeling the body and you're watching the thoughts and then all of a sudden, before you know it, you've jumped onto the thought train. And actually, the loneliness is now getting bigger. Now you're sobbing, actually, and huddled in a ball, and there's not much you're seeing, and you think you're looking at the thoughts, but actually you're just creating more and more, and it gets really big, you know? And that's not helpful. So we think that mindfulness tells us we have to just sit and watch it and be with it. But we have to be able to notice that we've gotten lost in it. So then how do I be with this moment? Maybe that's the time when we have to stand up, read a book, call a friend, go for a walk. That's mindfulness. That's wise action, right? So being with something, how do I be with something, not change it or get rid of it, but not make it bigger? So then how does mindfulness work with knee pain, right? So you're sitting, and maybe the way that you're working with it is to just sit there and notice it feels tight or really hot or throbbing, or it feels like you're being stabbing, you know. And you're just noticing it. But then maybe the noticing it makes it bigger, actually. The watching it makes it bigger, and it's creating all the stories about, oh my God, I can't do another half an hour. When's that bell going to ring? I can't do this. I can't sit here like this. And I have a knee injury, and is this going to make it bigger? And oh my God, what if I can't even, you know, I've experienced that, mate. You've experienced it, you know? So that's making it bigger. It's not being with it anymore. So then maybe right mindfulness, right action around this is to bring the attention to the breath or loving kindness. Right? How do I be with this with all the care and compassion for myself? You know, sometimes we just keep looking at it, but not trying to make it grow bigger, not trying to make it smaller. Sometimes, okay, knee pain, I'm going to bring my mindfulness to it with the subtle intention that if I'm going to open to it, with the subtle intention that when I do, it's going to go away. Right? But then that's also being motivated by craving, by aversion, the not wanting. So then we're suffering again. I had a really funny story about the mindfulness I wanted to share with you. It wasn't funny at the time, but I was in this conversation with a former employer that was very difficult. I have no idea what it was about, honestly, but it was very heated and very difficult. And she was saying something, and I honestly have no idea what she was saying, because I think there was so much anger in my experience. It was very big, so big that I was sitting there, and I'm not lying, I was sitting there beaming beams of hatred at her. Like, literally, through my eyes, I felt like I was just saying in my mind, I hate you, 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 I hate you. And it just went on like this. I think that's why I don't remember what the conversation was about. Because that's all that was going on in my experience. Just red hot hatred. And I was very mindful of it. That was the interesting thing. The whole time, I had just gotten off this 5-month retreat, and this was the situation I was in, and I was just watching it. Wow, you're really angry. It wasn't like, wow, it was a different kind of quality of wow. But I was seeing very clearly what was happening, and nothing changed. The anger did not go away. The beams of hatred did not go away. But I walked out of there, and the whole time I had not said a word. And when I left, it went away. The anger did go. Things go away. All on their own. That's the changing thing. Emotions, mindsets, it might be like this, coming and going so fast it feels like it's very solid. But it always goes away. All in its own time. But with this story, I didn't say something that I had to regret. And that's the difference. So with the kids in the schools, with mindful schools, this is the main point that we're teaching them. It's okay, whatever you're feeling, it's okay. You know, but when we bring attention to it, it gives us maybe just a little bit of space between the emotion and the reaction. And in this space lies choice. We can be the people we want to be. If we're not mindful, we have no choice. We just react out of greed, out of hatred, out of delusion. And then we're not living in alignment with our truth anymore. So mindfulness lets us choose to be the people we want to be in the world. Lets us see the ways that we're suffering so that we can uproot them. Wise effort. There's a lot of different wise efforts under this category. This is one that's always been really tricky to me with this striving energy. I know probably a lot of you have experienced that, you know, going between striving and then having absolutely no energy. But it also wise effort, not just referring to energy in our practice like that, but working around wholesome states. I love that it includes this. So we work a lot with the states of mind that are very difficult. But under the category of wise effort, the Buddha tells us, hey guys, guess what? Strengthen those wholesome qualities of mind. Go for it. You're experiencing joy. Make it bigger. Make it stronger. Have more. You're experiencing gratitude, generosity. Notice it. Be aware of it. Let it grow. Or you know how to do loving kindness? Do it. Bring that. Call that practice into the mind. See if it can open the heart. Feel that. And I love this because, you know, we can, suffering and craving, and it's all very intense and poignant. But this tells us that, remember, guys, this is a path to freedom, to happiness, real, true happiness. This is a path of, you've heard James say it, joy, right? This really is a path to happiness. This is what all of this Eightfold Path is all about, right? The end of suffering is a happy place. Maybe not a happy place like this, you know, but to sit in the midst of the tumultuous storms of life and just be content, totally happy. So with wise effort, the Buddha says, really cultivate these wholesome qualities of mind. Really go for it. And he says other things. There's four wise efforts. We don't have time to go through them all, but I really love that one. So it's a path of happiness, and it's really hard, isn't it? It's not really easy for any of us. It goes against everything we've ever known, really, of how to be, what to want, what brings us happiness. And it's really not easy to sit on a cushion or in a chair for 40 minutes. It's not an easy thing to do. Remember on that 5-month retreat going into a teacher and saying, this is too hard, I can't do this, it's just too hard, it's too hard. And she just leaned forward with all the compassion that I've ever seen a teacher have for me and just say, yes, this is the hardest thing you're ever going to have to do, but the most rewarding. Okay, I'll do it. Yeah. Another teacher, the first retreat I ever went to at Shambhala Mountain Center, I went to Naropa for undergrad, and I got to do this retreat with Dale Azrael, this Acharya. Can you still hear her voice? Not too tight, not too loose. Not too tight, not too loose. So the effort that we bring to our sitting practice, really to anything, just that middle way, that balance. So let me just let ourselves rest in the practice. It's difficult. It takes a little bit of effort to actually rest. It's a paradox. And so when we've discovered that balance, that perfect balance that is changing all the time, but that balance of not too tight, not too loose, then the mind becomes gathered. In that place of relaxation around practice, concentration develops. And that's our last path factor. I'm going to tell you a story. This is a story I tell the kids. They love this story. I know you're going to love it too. Okay. So once upon a time, a long time ago, but not so long ago, there lived a little boat. And this little boat decided he wanted to go on a journey all the way around the world. And he was a brave little boat. He decided he was going to go all by himself. Didn't want anyone to go with him. So he was thinking and getting ready for his trip. He started to get a little worried about what happens if I fall asleep at night? And no, there's no one there to know where I am. And what if I just get lost? Oh, and then I wake up and I have no idea where I am. He was very worried. But he was a wise, bright little boat. And he thought, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll bring with me an anchor. And when I fall asleep at night, you know, I'll throw it off the side of the boat. He was very happy with himself. So the first day, he set out on his trip around the world, and he sailed, and he sailed, and he saw many beautiful things that first day. And by the end of the first night, he got very tired. He said, now I will throw my anchor down. So he took his anchor, and he threw it down, and it went down, 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 hit the bottom of the ocean floor with a thud. And that night, sure enough, he fell asleep. He started to drift this way, but the anchor pulled it back. And then he started to drift this way, but the anchor pulled it back. And then he started to drift this way, but the anchor pulled it back. He even drifted this way, but the anchor pulled it back. All night long, drifting, pulling back. And when the little boat woke up in the morning, he saw that he was in the same place he was when he fell asleep. He was so happy. And he pulled up his anchor, and he continued his sailing journey all across the world, never once getting lost, using his anchor every night. He sailed across 7 great oceans all the way home. He was so happy. I was thinking about this. Why don't kids love this? Teachers love it too. It's because I realize it's because of this. This is why I love it. I lull myself with it. You know, like it's this drifted this way. And I think that's what it is. This is the quality that we have got to bring to our concentration practice. It's got to be this quality of, yes, the mind drifts, and then we just bring it back. It goes and thinks about dinner, and then we come back. What I have to do tomorrow, and then I come back. Oh, God, I can't believe I did that when I was 5 years old, and then I come back, you know? Just with that energy of, it's okay. Just bringing the mind back, just like you would do with a child, you know, or a little puppy dog or something. It's that energy, and when we have that kind of energy, and when we bring it to our meditation practice, our concentration practice, and we come back to the same object of our awareness over and over and over again with this energy, it gathers the mind in a powerful way, and it creates a fierce light, a strong light. The mind is capable of such power, and it creates this piercing, blinding light. And when we come out of the concentration practice and we open to all phenomena of our mind, everything around us, and we look and we shine that mind, that light, on everything, and everything becomes crystal clear. Oh, that's craving, that's wanting, that's not wanting. Oh, that's what's going on. And it just sees so clearly. And so that's why it's the last path factor, because it brings us back to the beginning. Okay, now we have this powerful mind where we come back to the beginning and we're looking what's causing suffering and where's the end of suffering, the Four Noble Truths. And then we come back to it in a deeper way. And then we go through them all again. Like I said, sometimes it's system theory. So we're working with mindfulness with our intention and mindfulness with our livelihood or mindfulness with whatever, you know. They're also bouncing all around the room. But they're also working like a spiral. Deeper and deeper levels of understanding. So we can use this teaching to just be happier, just be good. Or we can really take this teaching to heart and use it for our full awakening. We can spiral all the way till we're there. We're happy. Really, truly happy. So we get to decide how we want to use this. We want to just be happier, that's fine. Do we want to really awaken right now in this lifetime? And it will happen right now. Not sometime in the future, it will happen now. Whenever that now is, so it will always happen right now. I think it's really possible. We've tasted it, little flavors of it, real awakening. I'm going to close with a lovely quote that inspires me so much right now. It's from this book, Women on the Way and of the Way. Women on the Way, Women of the Way. It's a story of Taijitsu, an 18th century nun. It says, "Standing on the small porch of Hakujuan, she saw the shadow of a little wren cross the footpath, followed by the shadow of a hungry cow. And she saw the little wren arose, abided, and fell away. Then she knew there was nothing more than this. No ground, nothing to lean on stronger than the cane she held, nothing to lean upon at all, and no one leaning. And she opened the clenched fist in her mind and let go and fell into the midst of everything." So let's just sit for a moment. She opened the clenched fist in her mind and let go and fell into the midst of everything. Thank you for your attention. May the goodness that we've created in our practice, in our coming together, may it be shared with all beings everywhere.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.